I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like.
What's up, world? Welcome to another edition of I Mix What I Like. IMixWhatILike.org at I Mix What I Like for all your relevant social media. Again, I'm Jared Ball. Happy to be your host. Please do check back with us and subscribe at the website and keep up with everything that's going on. Again, at IMixWhatILike.org. And of course, follow us again at I Mix What I Like for all your relevant social media. We have a great interview lined up for today with an editor and contributor to a brand new book that, as we'll talk a little bit about, I'm more than happily honored to be two pages a part of. Poverty Scholarship from the People's School. Poor People Led: Theory, Art, Words, and Tears Across Mama Earth. And we're joined to discuss this work and more by Lisa Tiny Gray Garcia. Lisa, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having us. And yeah, I do a little intro. If you're ready for it, I'll let you know whenever you are.
Oh, no, let's go. Yeah, please do.
Okay. So I always first start by honoring my mama, a houseless, disabled, half a Boricua orphan who barely survived dealing with the kind of, you know, racism and poverty that's so rampant in this stolen land. So Mama D, without whom there be no me, to the first peoples of this land, in your territory, that would be probably Pequot in Lenape, out here in Palipas Aslan, it would be Lashon, Ohlone peoples. But also then say, I am a poverty scholar, that houseless mama, that houseless daughter. I'm a poverty scholar. All the people you don't want to see, never want to be, look away from me. What you going to do, arrest me? We're in your city. Yeah, and I'm a poverty scholar, and I usually rock my jailhouse attire because me and my poor mama did the poverty crime of being houseless in this indigenous holler. So, I'm a poet, and as you might imagine, and I'm a writer on many things, but I'm also what I call a poverty scholar. And I say that because that's a crucial part of, you know, what the book is about. And in terms of what it means to even sort of rep that space in this context in the U.S. in this stolen land is really central to the reason that all of us put that book out.
Well, I definitely wanted to start with that concept and even to talk a little bit about what it means in relationship to the work where I think we first came in contact through your work with Poor Magazine, P-O-O-R Magazine. What, if you would, say a word about that magazine and that collective effort, and then as you outlined a little bit, let's have you unpack a little bit more this concept of the poverty scholar. What is poverty scholarship, and even how is it related to the People's School?
Well, first of all, Poor Magazine, started as an actual physical magazine. Me and my ma, when we were dealing with extreme homelessness and poverty, my mom, as I said, was an orphan. Her, body was literally, abused over 210 times in foster care and orphanages. She was an unprotected child, which is arguably one of the most dangerous things to be anywhere in Mama Earth. And how she came out of that to even, raise up and get with my colonizer dad, because she was taught whiteness was rightness, as most people are in this place. And have me is, an act of resistance, and it continues. People call that resilience sometimes. I don't know about that. I know that as poor folks, as poor mamas, we put on our clothes and we keep it moving. I know that that was what my mom did. And by any means necessary, she managed to, raise me up as a poor single parent on welfare, or health fare, as we call it at Poor Magazine. And we started a project called the Welfare Queen, small W, capital Q. But anyway, and then, at a certain point, she was laid off from, she come off welfare, she got a J-O-B, she got made it by any means, and then started practicing what she and we call revolutionary social work in a group home for houseless children. And that was really more about resisting the notion of CPS, you know, of the criminalizing of poor families. It was about family restoration instead of family separation. And these are all concepts that we unpack in the book and the work that we do. After she got laid off for doing that work, for doing the real work, for her it was like, she used to say, another little murder of the soul. And she couldn't just keep on keeping on. She had done that, as many of our mothers do, you know. And at a certain point, just was unable to function. And we became houseless when I was 11 years old. And at that point, I had to drop out of formal institutions of learning and enroll full-time in the School of Hard Knocks, as I call it, where I graduated with a PhD in poverty. I'm not glamorizing that at all. That time and those times, which actually spanned the rest of my childhood, almost killed us, literally. These positions of crisis for families, literally lead to, you know, the plantation prison nation, lead to the incarceration nation, to houselessness. And we ended up sleeping in our car. We ended up, unable to pay the rent because she couldn't work anymore. And, and then our cars were towed because they were hoopties and, you know, driving while poor, driving while black and brown, they were towed for little reasons like registration, all these other things. And then we ended up on park benches and doorways and shelter beds, wherever we could basically be. And that continued and didn't stop, because those positions of poverty oftentimes just become worse. What happened at 18 is I ended up being arrested. So like I said in the beginning, I rocked my jailhouse attire. I ended up being put in county jail for 3 months for the act of being houseless. In other words, getting citations while we were sleeping in our car and sleeping on the street. Because I think you probably already know that, you know, one of the many ways that poor folks, black and brown peoples, are predated upon is through these criminalizing laws were actually set up, you know, originally like that by what I affectionately call the stealing fathers, not the founding fathers, who, you know, imported or exported, I don't know which one it would be, they, you know, these ideas, these pauper laws, these ugly laws, all of these ways in which poor bodies are criminalized for the act of being poor, the act of being a person of color, the act of being indigenous. And there's a whole history, you know, and history of genocide behind that. Of enslaved African peoples, of enslaved indigenous peoples. But those ways continue today. You know, we have on the books in the Bay Area over 160 laws that make it illegal to be unhoused. And you may think I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. In St. Petersburg, Florida, you can be arrested for the act of leaning while houseless. In Atlanta, in New York, in D.C., I mean, on and on, where y'all are, there's an endless amount of laws that basically criminalize the unhoused body for being seen, for being outside, for seeking shelter. So anyway, back to our original origin story, our creation story, as we say it, we were, at that point, things got really even worse. And I tried to end my life, and there was just this horrible, we couldn't even make art anymore. We were making art about our life and also just making art on selling on the street to survive. The reason I had to drop out of school is to not only take care of my mama, but also do an underground business on the street, selling art, which I did instead of going to school. I'm not complaining about that, and I'm not glamorizing that. That was what we did to survive, just like families all over Mama Earth. People don't really relate that kind of poverty experience to the U.S., but it happens all the time. It's just that oftentimes families can't be seen, because if you're seen, you'll be separated. You know, you're considered, parents are considered unfit and all these other terms. So at that point, a whole series of things started to happen. One of which I met my mom, that my mom found, you know, because a lot of us poor mamas are what I would call resource geniuses. So she found a revolutionary lawyer who helped poor folks, which is very unusual. And he actually converted my 2,000 hours of community service that they gave me after I got out of jail into a writing assignment. He asked me, what can you do? And I never thought of myself as a writer. And that was the first, what I consider like intervention or milagro that happened that changed our life. The next one is that we met the first landlord who didn't evict us the first time we didn't have the rent. And then my mom started to seek, you know, the knowledge that had been sort of taken from her as a colonized person of color. She started to sit on my Black studies and Lhasa studies and Indigenous studies classes at San Francisco State, met people like Erica Huggins and Dr. Tina Soleil and some other, Dr. Wade Noble, some other powerful, you know, teachers who started to make us both think about the relationship between poor families all over Mama Earth and our connections in this stolen land. And at that point, it was a power dream, as I believe, from our ancestors. But we visioned the idea of Poor Magazine. And as poor people do, we went about making it happen by any means necessary, some of which I will not talk about, you know, beg, borrow, and steal, do whatever we had to do to create this beautiful container that was our dream of art for voices who are often silenced, who are talked about us without us, so that we could lift up our own solutions. And in that moment, along with several other poverty scholars, that we started to also lift up this original theory of poverty scholarship. And also in that moment, sleeping in that car, sleeping on that doorway, me and my mama dreamed up homefulness, which is, you know, people need to wrap their mouths around that. A homeless people's solution to homelessness. And that was the beginning. And it was, you know, it continued as a magazine. We continue to make media. A very important part about what we do is the media, the art, the storytelling, the theater, because we're also cultural workers and poets. We're artists. Oftentimes not labels that are, you know, given to poor folks, to houseless folks. So it's a very important part of it. And in that time, we created this magazine, created four issues of this beautiful, intentionally beautiful magazine called Poor Magazine. The first one was called Homefulness. The second one was called Healthcare, H-E-L-L-T-H, care, about poor people healthcare. The third one was called Work, about unrecognized poor people labor. And the fourth one was Mothers. And at that point, we started to realize that this needed to be more about a movement. This needed to be more about actually enacting these poor people-led solutions. And that's when we kind of expanded what we were doing, got a 501c3. Not because we wanted to be a non-profiteer or any of the other ways that oftentimes people make money off of poor people's lives that we talk about in the book, but because rich people have a problem giving to poor folks if there's not a piece of paper in the middle. So we had to gain that legitimacy, and we keep that paper by any means necessary, that 501c3. And we're really doing the work. And a lot of times people don't actually believe that it's possible. You know,
but you also, you know, we're talking right now with Lisa Tiny Gray Garcia about a new book she's edited. Like you said, it's a beautiful piece of work filled with art and a variety of writing called Poverty Scholarship, Poor People Led Theory, Art, Words, and Tears Across Mama Earth. You know, you mentioned this issue of that you all are a nonprofit, but a lot of your work is a critique of that structure and the process by which struggle actually occurs in and around these and related issues. So you even have a brief poem in the book that says, "No matter how many times you study me, it doesn't get me a home." So I wanted to pick up on that because I definitely have my own limited experience, both with homelessness, which ended up quickly with a brief bout of crime and a 4-year sentence in the United States Navy, and also a brief bout of struggling with nonprofits and all that is and is not of value in that as it relates to actually changing the material and lived conditions of people they claim to be working for.
Right.
So just start with this piece that you have. You know, and maybe have you talk a little bit about your own status as a nonprofit or working within that structure. But then this again, this poem where you write, no matter how many times you study me, it doesn't get me a home.
Right. Well, that's the shared critique of both what I affectionately call AKKdemia and the nonprofiteers or the nonprofit industrial complex. So thank you for bringing that out. I also add, no matter how many times you put me in jail, it doesn't give me a home. And so that said, first of all, that I want to shout out to my brother Leroy Moore, one of the co-producers and co-founders of Homefulness, and my fellow Poe Poet, and all of the fellow poverty scholars at Poor Magazine, Motiado and Vivi and Quinandi. There's so many of us. So much love. But he has a poem in the piece called Nonprofit Can't Get No Profit. Nonprofit Can't Get No Time. One of the really sad pieces of what this structure, this U.S. structure is set on, is a corporate structure. So let's get real about that for a second. People oftentimes think, well, I'm going to do good for poor people and I'm going to get, you know, do nonprofit work. Well, nonprofits are set up as a for-profit corporation. Actually, if people look at the tax code, it's almost exactly the same. So it's a really interesting aha moment if people, even middle of the road people, want to look at that with the board and all of these other things, right? So one of the reasons that Poor Magazine has that 501c3, which we do have in good standing and all that stuff, is as a poor people-led movement, as a landless people's movement, who align ourselves with the Shack Dwellers Union in South Africa, shout out to those beautiful cats, to the Zapatistas in Chiapas, to landless people's movement in Brazil, to Move Africa, right here in Philly, is because we found that specifically within the U.S., and I don't know outside of the U.S. that well, but the real piece here is if you don't have a piece of paper that somehow legitimizes you, folks with different forms of race and class and formal education privilege will not believe that you're real. You know, what are you going to do with that? I've actually had people in what I affectionately call philanthropists say, we're not giving directly to the poor people. What are they going to do with that money? I mean, it's literally like that. All that racism and classism just comes into play. So we keep that piece of paper so that people feel safe on the real. We operate, on the other hand, as a poor people-led movement. And that means a very different kind of a structure. It's kind of this notion of indigenous organizing that we bring up in the book and the ways in which we honor our ancestors. We walk through all of this with prayer, multi-spirited prayer from all different directions. I say the revolution will not be melted in a pot, so we all come to spirit differently. We honor our elders. We practice eldership with a multi-generational family. We have a youth project and part of our decision-making body. So that whole piece is really the ways in which many our multi-nation ancestors operated. But going back to the specific critique, the sad part is that the not-for-profit corporate entities, which are part of this huge, basically billion-dollar industry that I call the nonprofit industrial complex, as well as other people do, and what I add, nonprofiteers, is it's built on this savior complex. It's built on the profiting off of our pain. And sadly, most of academic institutional degree programs are as well. And if you look in the book, there's that piece as well. So I critique all of that. And I just want to be real about this, not to dismantle it. But as I say, make space on the bench, Paulo Freire and Howard Zinn, because the population is bringing the popular education on this one. In other words, honor that there can be another route to our shared strival, right? And that it doesn't include the savior complex. So to break that down, the idea that, we have to throw some crumbs at the houseless folks. We have to you know, build another $1 billion shelter so we can provide transitional housing and solve problems for people. That, and similarly with law that happens and medicine and all of these things, but never in that is there the honoring of the knowledge that us folks have ourselves. And sadly, then in that not-for-profit, you know, corporate structure, people get harmed. I'm curious to hear your nightmare with that. But the reality is that most people who work in those industries and are there, you know, with a good heart, right, good intentions, are still operating with that construct of a corporate structure. You have outcomes. You have to produce and get this many things done. Why? Because it's built on philanthropimping, which goes back even more, and that's what I call it. You know, the multi-million dollar, possibly billion dollar, philanthropy industrial complex, which, dictates project-based helping, right? So again, if you want to go back to history and history of genocide, the first philanthropists in the U.S. were slave owners. And we talk about that in the book. A very important part about this solution, this poor people-led solution that we lift up about homefulness, about all of these things, is this notion that we developed called radical redistribution and community reparations. And it's not to be confused with Black and Japanese, you know, communities' reparations, but specifically rooted in interdependence, the relationship between humans, the way that people practice the violent act of looking away in the U.S. But I can't solve that problem, so I'm not going to look at it. And the way that then these nonprofiteers become the answer to people's feeling of, oh, I can't do enough, so let me give, you know, money to the Red Cross or Salvation Army. Actually, we critique the notion of private property ownership itself. We critique these notions of industries built on our suffering. And what we say is, let's actually practice a different way. Let's practice a way that actually goes back to people unselling Mama Earth. That people's industrial bloodstained dollar, you know, accumulation is the problem, actually. And that we're in a state of emergency. I don't have to tell any of your listeners or you that this society right now in the U.S., not only is Mama Earth in a climate destruction state of emergency, which we talk about and we relate and include, but our people, all of us, are in a state of emergency. Capitalism can't continue like this. And so we're putting out a completely, arguably, a shift in consciousness. And in that shift, we're asking these nonprofit industrial complex workers, these other, you know, CEOs, if you will, these academics, to stand with us in solidarity, that we have solutions of our own that can work, and that we just need to be listened to and understood as scholars ourselves. And therein lies the notion of poverty scholarship. It's basically rooted in lived knowledge, not learned, not paid for. Arguably, it is paid for because you pay with your body and your soul and your heart. But lived knowledge is a form of legitimate knowledge. And we have solutions to these issues, and we need to be understood and heard.
We're talking with Lisa Tiny Gray Garcia about her work, collective piece of work, Poverty Scholarship from the People's School, Poor People Led Theory, Art, Words, and Tears Across Mama Earth, a collection of really fascinating essays, all emanating in a variety of ways from the perspectives you've just heard somewhat laid out here. I will just tell you this very quickly. It's a story I often share in terms of my nonprofit experience. I don't have any real deep working within the nonprofit structure myself. But I was once, but I felt that this experience is, you know, a perfect example and indicative of what you're talking about. I was invited some years ago by someone who does a lot of work in that, invited to this meeting in Washington, D.C., and I was invited under the conditions that I would not speak, that it was known, or was at least thought, where I might end up going, what my response might be. So I had to just sit quietly. And what it was a gathering of people who, representing almost every community you could think of in the nonprofit world, every racial group, more or less, I guess, based just along every racial group. I don't know if they were dealing specifically with gender, and I know nobody was there specifically dealing with homelessness, other than as a subset of all the issues facing all the groups that they were there to represent. But it was this long, big table around which everybody sat, and each group gave their presentations, more or less summarizing a variation of the same thing. None of us are doing well. There's a whole bunch of inequality. We need help. And at the end of this was a comment from the keynote invited guest, who was at the time Jared Bernstein, who was at that time then Vice President Joe Biden's chief economic advisor. And Jared Bernstein sits up in his very nice suit and a nice smile, and he looks around the room, and he basically says, I'm paraphrasing, but this is almost exactly his point. He just said, I appreciate hearing everything from everybody. I just need to inform you that we have nothing in the pipeline as a policy or agenda item that's going to address any of the issues that any of you brought up. And then he kind of just smiled and got up and walked out of the room.
Oh my God.
But it was a perfect example of I think, at least a subset of the problem, that you have a lot of people there in this very nice office in downtown Washington, D.C., all of the people there who have been highly, you know, very well paid to create these very stylish and substantive reports, all then who are funded to go give these reports to someone at this meeting, which concludes that there's no help coming, other than what they can do with that experience is go back to their philanthropists, as you point out, and get more funding to do more research that will never address the problems that they could. So I wanted to have you to sort of take us to a conclusion of this interview or this discussion by having, you know, respond to something else that you wrote here that really resonates with me, particularly as it reminds me of one of my favorite hip hop songs, classic from Redman, I be that. Because you hear, I'm your patient, consumer, client, service resistant, difficult, and non-compliant. Whatever acronym you can write it down in my fat PHAT file. I'm all those things you call me. Every time you try to case mangle antisocial work and nonprofit off my broken poverty.
So there you go.
I read that. I heard Redman saying, I am every, you know, you call me whatever, and I be that. And basically the problem never gets fixed. We just keep on moving. So Lisa Tiny Gray Garcia, sort of as any kind of concluding remarks you want to give or leave us with, build off of the example I gave there, but definitely leading people to where they can go to get this book and follow up on some of this work in here.
Yeah, well, I'll start by saying another one. First of all, I love Redman. Yes. I'll start by saying one of my lines. Change won't come from a savior, a pimp, or an institution. Change will only come from a poor people-led revolution. I want to specifically just point out that we do this thing called People School, where we teach young folks with race and class and formal education privilege about the notion of radical redistribution, about community reparations, and that's how we're actually currently building Homefulness, which is housing the first four families right now, which we're, you know, very slowly, incrementally building homes and this liberation school called Decolonized Academy and the Sliding Scale Cafe, which we hope is a template for all of Mama Earth. We're actually being invited into Chico right now, which suffered the really serious fires and all of these other things. And we are going actually on a tour back east. We're going to go back to your area. We're going to be part of the Poor People's Army, which is doing a concert with Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign in D.C. on the 31st. So we'll be there. If people want more information, they can hit me up directly on my website, lisatinygraygarcia.com, or email poormag@gmail.com, or they can also get the book at Poor Press, P-O-O-R Press, no space, .net, poorpress.net. And you can guide us on all the social media. We're on Twitter and Facecrack and Instascam and all that at Poor Magazine or at Poverty Scholar. But I do want to say specifically on that piece that in that teaching that we do, one of the things that we teach, and leaving your audience with this one, is a lot of poor folks are called order clutterers, right? Because we collect, you know, too many envelopes, or like 6,000 pairs of, you know, socks, like my poor mama did. That's all she could ever afford. And she was trying to be warm always, because we've been so long cold. But what we say is that people who have, you know, three homes and a vacation home in the Bahamas, how are they not considered hoarder clutterers? How is having a Jaguar and a Mercedes and something else not a hoarder clutter disease? And how have we all, you know, bought into the idea that buying and selling Mama Earth is a profit-making venture? And so one of the pieces that we teach folks is about the notion of actually a radical redistribution, interdependence, and sharing, a real sharing, not a like or a foot, hands up, you know, of the digital media sharing, but a real sharing economy that actually is rooted in love and is rooted in poverty scholarship. And, you know, I would just say to listeners, you know, we're down to come and teach and share this. This is the idea behind the book. Get it and read it and take in that medicine and realize that, you know, us poor folks have solutions to our own problems, that we are there to work in solidarity, and that there's a different way to really think through and understand even ideas behind, like, social workers, I call anti-social workers, and case management. You know, stop doing things about us without us. Stop writing about us without us. Stop creating more and more solutions that are really, really not real. And start listening to us poverty scholars.
All right. Well, thank you once again to Lisi Tiny Gray Garcia and the entire Poor family, the Poverty Scholarship crew, the People School crew. Again, it's Poverty Scholarship, Poor People Led Theory, Art, Words, and Tears Across Mama Earth. Thank you so much again for joining us here at I Mix What I Like. And as we know, you know, to you we say peace, as Fred Hampton used to say, because we know you're willing to fight for it. So peace.
I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like.